when they closed that, part of the concern was that the reactor vessel itself had gone through so many thermal cycles that it was brittle and it could just literally shatter. Their concern was that the thing would just shatter. So they actually shut it down. Well, there's all sorts of parts to the Vermont Yankee plant that are really irreplaceable. You can't really replace the reactor vessel. You just really can't do that. It's too vital a component of the plant. And then you have things like your steam tubes, mm-hmm. which are big, massive tubes, and they started off with very thick walls, but as the steam goes through there at thousands of feet per second, year in and year out, mm-hmm. the walls start corroding and wearing down, and they get thinner and thinner. Just a few months ago, they had a steam pipe explosion at a nuclear plant in Japan that killed 7 workers. And that made the news. It was a pretty big, it was not a nuclear accident, but it was a very serious reliability issue. They had to shut the plant down. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that the Vermont Public Service Board can look at, by the way, is reliability and some environmental impacts. Mm-hmm. They cannot look at safety, which seems ridiculous, but the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has full preemption on nuclear safety. Mm-hmm. So we have no say on nuclear safety, other than the pressure that we can put through our elected officials on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Mm-hmm. And I highly recommend that people who are listening to this call Senator Judd Gregg. Mm-hmm. He's actually been pretty good on nuclear issues. He has written to the NRC. He's demanded some accountability. He needs to know that his constituents are concerned about these issues. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And like I say, it's three issues. Boosting power is the first, and that's the most dangerous. Then you have the dry cast storage, which is it's basically creating a nuclear waste dump right on the border of New Hampshire, and people here should be very concerned about that, creating a terrorist targets that could be damaged by a shoulder held missile.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, small weapons could pierce one of these things and start a radiological release that could have serious consequences. Mm-hmm. on the people living right here, mm-hmm. and then the license extension. Mm-hmm. And all of these issues you should talk to your senator about.
So what is Plan B if somehow you're successful, we are successful in curbing or perhaps shutting down Yankee? What is Plan B? What would be the economic consequences of shutting down Yankee on the area?
Well, the economic consequences are somewhat unknown, and this is one of the features of Entergy's current lobbying effort, is to threaten the dire consequences. What they really spell out is the dire consequences of plant closure. They brought up their whole dog and pony show up to the one of the House committees that is looking at this dry cast storage issue, and they're basically blackmailing the state. They're saying, if you don't give us permission to do this, we're probably going to shut the plant down in 2007. Mm-hmm. All these people are going to be thrown out of work. Well, New England Coalition is working on doing a economic impact study to really show what the consequences could be. Mm-hmm. There was an economic impact study done at Wiscasset, Maine, once the Maine Yankee reactor shut down in 1997. And actually, some interesting things happened there. The price of electricity went down after the plant closed. Mm-hmm. The economy there diversified. Certainly some people lost their jobs, but in the nuclear industry right now, because the industry itself has basically been moribund, it has not a nuclear power plant has been licensed or financed since after Three Mile Island, and even before Three Mile Island, mm-hmm. since the Browns Ferry fire in 1974, mm-hmm. there have been no new ones commissioned to be built. Mm-hmm. So it's basically a dying industry, mm-hmm. but so there's a huge shortage of nuclear workers. Because people aren't training for that anymore.
Sure.
So nuclear workers can get a job really easily.
Mm-hmm.
They won't suffer individually. The community would suffer some economic loss, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there's who knows what they might be able to use something else, put natural gas generating plant in there, or some other, make some other use.
Mm-hmm.
But the answers to the region's energy problems really do need to be forward-looking. And I know this is something that you've been very interested in with the Monadnock Freedom Forum, and it's something that I've been interested long-range myself.
Well, can we talk about that a little bit? I was talking before the show about peak oil, and peak oil, for those who may not be familiar with it, is the point at which the supply for oil is outstripped by the demand for oil, and with the growth of India and China and their industrial sector, years ago they talked about peak oil being, you know, 2020, 2025, 2030. And now there are some reliable estimates that are saying that peak oil will actually hit us much sooner, as early as 2007, and which means our reliance on oil and gas and everything that comes from oil is going to be changed. I mean, we can't keep doing the same old thing. So can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, and it's quite likely to be extremely dramatic. I mean, already we're seeing, I mean, what's happened in the past year and a half has been pretty dramatic. You know, oil going from below $30 a barrel up to over 50. That's pretty significant. And it's going to go higher. I mean, it's going to drop back and forth. It's going to do a little bit of a dance. But what you said is true. Hubert's peak is a fellow named Hubert analyzed this thing actually a number of years ago and predicted that the peak of production versus the demand, those two lines on the graph would cross well prior to 2000. And there's certainly some speculation that point has already been reached, but that the impacts of it are going to start hitting us in the next few years, mm-hmm. when the availability of oil, because there's a lag between production and use.
That's right.
And you know, at any one time, that's why I always laugh with certain cynicism when they have a problem in the Mideast or a fire in Nigeria or something, and then the very next day the prices of gas at our pumps go up, when in fact the price of the oil hasn't gone up yet.
Yeah.
A long delay.
I've always wondered about that.
Sure, they're profiteering like mad.
Indeed.
But the answer to these problems is really not on the supply side, the way the Bush administration is trying to tout it, because all of the Bush administration friends and donors are, you know, I mean, there's a lot of them that are big oil people.
Indeed.
And they profit very greatly by coming up with supply side solutions. But the real solutions have to be on the demand side, improving gas efficiency. Mileage efficiencies of automobiles is the number one way, mm-hmm. of number one cutting our dependence on foreign oil, mm-hmm. which we really need to do, because our entire foreign policy is driven by this outrageous dependence. People driving sport utility vehicles, wake up, folks. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. If you're driving a sport utility vehicle, if you have seven kids in it, I can understand. But if you're driving around by yourself in a sport utility vehicle or a Hummer, you know, you really got to look at what your impact is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're getting 10 miles a gallon and you could be getting 60 and you're just driving yourself around, you're a big part of the problem, folks.
Mm-hmm.
You're one of the reasons that we have folks dying over in Iraq right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a war for domination of the oil markets,
mm-hmm.
so that we can ensure that we can keep guzzling oil.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is insulation for homes. Here in New England, we depend very heavily on heating oil. But we have very inefficient homes,
mm-hmm.
and businesses. So we can dramatically reduce the amount of heating oil that we need by insulating our homes. Now, right now, we haven't reached the point where the economic drivers are strong enough to justify for the average homeowner to go and re-insulate their homes in most cases, unless your insulation is really bad,
mm-hmm.
because it's expensive to make those changes. But when, and this will be driven by the market,
mm-hmm.
when oil hits $75, $100 a gallon, I mean a barrel,
right.
when heating oil, you know, currently people have seen a doubling of their heating oil prices in the past year or so. When that doubles again, then the cost of adding insulation to your home, and going in and adding double glazed windows and really making your home energy efficient,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the energy hog that it now likely is,
mm-hmm.
then the market will drive those changes,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then we'll be able to cut our reliance.
So what do we do as a community, as a regional community consciousness? What do we do to avoid being reactive to the situation and waiting till it happens? And realistically, given the political culture and the political climate in the country, and there seems to be a definite lack of will to think beyond the next election or even think as far as the next election. What do we realistically do as a concerned citizenry given these limitations in our elected officials and perhaps even in our neighbors and perhaps even in ourselves to some degree. If we see this coming down the pike in maybe just 2 years, what do we do now? What do we do today?
Responsible people who really care can do a lot. I mean, you can become very conscious of how you use your automobile. You can become very economical in how you use it. A lot of times we make unnecessary trips, you know, we places where we could walk. We jump in the car to drive two blocks down to the, you know, video store. You know, we do things that are almost very unconscious. If we're thinking, I'll tell you what makes you really conscious. Go on a camping trip with your batteries and your single tank of, you know, little butane or propane stove. You suddenly become very, very conscious. Or live in a solar home for a few days, and you start realizing, I can't leave these lights on and let them burn all the time.
Yep.
Because when you're creating and directly responsible for your own energy, not when it's coming through the wires and spinning a meter and you get hit with an energy bill once a month, that's a very slow feedback mechanism.
Sure.
But the feedback mechanism of going camping and not leaving your flashlight on all night, for example, because your batteries are going to be dead, and then you're going to be facing bears and wolves without a flashlight, conceivably. Or, you know, living in a solar home and realizing if you use a hairdryer, it's going to, you know, if you use it outrageously and try to turn on everything and just have energy flowing unnecessarily, you're going to use up what you have. So those kinds of things are great learning experiences. And if you start applying those to how you go around your own home, leaving your computer on all night in the office, when you walk out of your office and leave your computer on, that thing is using up an enormous amount of energy. A computer uses about, a standard desktop computer uses about 100 watts. Well, you do the math, you multiply that out, and for every kilowatt of energy, that's 1,000 watts. So 10 hours of your computer being on uses the equivalent of about 2 pounds of coal. That's being burned in some fossil fuel plant someplace to create electricity. Well, that's a pretty big impact. You multiply that by hundreds of thousands of people leaving their computers on all night. That's an awful lot of coal, a lot of CO2 that's going up. And people think that it doesn't matter as an individual. It's such a small thing. But you multiply that out, your individual actions are enormously important.
Yes. We're talking about Amory Lovins ending the oil end game, winning the oil end game of the Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory Lovins. And
RMI.org.
Indeed. And all talking also about a lot about conservation, all about what you're talking about in terms of getting more energy efficiency in our automobiles and trucks, perhaps biofuels as well, development of biofuels, which has been discussed on earlier programs here. What other alternative sources of energy do you see coming down the pike or available now that might be helpful to help alleviate what it looks like it's going to be a difficult time in a few years for us? And what do you say about hydrogen? We've got about 9 minutes left.
I want to talk about hydrogen, but before I get into hydrogen, I want to emphasize energy efficiency. And from the comments that I just made, people might get the wrong idea that it's just a matter of tightening your belt and, you know, turning off the lights and shivering in the dark. You know, that was the old metaphor that was used when Jimmy Carter tried to implement conservation. And it was one of the things that Ronald Reagan torpedoed like crazy and made a mockery of energy efficiency and conservation. Energy efficiency is actually making more efficient use of the resource. And the most easy example is miles per gallon in a car. You know, you can drive a hybrid vehicle and get 60 miles a gallon or 70 miles a gallon, or you can drive a Hummer and get 8 or 9. And you're getting the same amount of work out of the thing, except your ego might be getting a greater gratification from the Hummer if you're a certain type of person. But energy efficiency does not mean doing without. It means doing a better job with what you have. And it's a very simple concept, and it saves money. It's a really good idea. It saves money. Mm-hmm. It gives you resources to use in other places. Hydrogen is not so much a fuel source as a fuel carrier, as an energy carrier. And the reason is that hydrogen does not appear in nature as a mineable source. It's not like you can go and dig the coal. I mean, you can dig the coal, which was created by solar energy and photosynthesis and then fossilization over, you know, hundreds of thousands and millions of years that organic matter was gradually turned into coal from solar energy. Hydrogen is something that does not generally appear in nature on its own. It has to be separated from other elements that it combines with.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the classic case is H2O, which is water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it takes energy to free the bond, to break the bond between the oxygen and the hydrogen. It takes a lot of energy.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it with hydrolysis, is that the right term?
Mm-hmm.
And you can use solar panels to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually not a bad way of taking solar energy and converting it into a usable fuel
mm-hmm.
that is very different from the electricity that you're creating. You know, once you create hydrogen, then you've created a portable fuel, and it can be used in an automobile pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
And a fuel cell, for example, is a great way of using that hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
But it shouldn't be mistaken as a fuel source.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to free the hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be an energy loss there. There's a transition loss. There's
sure.
always, every time you change a form that energy appears in, there's going to be an efficiency loss.
Well, so it costs money to take oil out of the ground. It costs money to dig coal out of the ground. What is the comparison, I guess, right now for transmuting water into hydrogen or other sources into hydrogen?
Right now, it's not as cheap as coal by any means.
Sure.
You know, it's a lot cheaper to go, unless you look at the externalized costs of coal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact that the EPA has estimated that 30,000 people a year in this country are dying as a result of particulate matter being emitted from coal-burning power plants in this country alone.
Mm-hmm.
30,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Keep in mind, as opposed to the 1,300 that have died in Iraq,
mm-hmm.
or the 50,000 that died in Vietnam, 30,000 a year are dying because we're mining coal and burning it
mm-hmm.
to create electricity
mm-hmm.
in this country that we're using wastefully.
Mm-hmm.
So,
just to put that in perspective, about how much exposure would it take, how many years of exposure to kill those people? I mean, is this over the number of, you know, 10 or 20 years that it builds up kind of thing? Or is
you know, I don't know those details.
Yeah.
It's especially dangerous for children.
Yeah.
We have high levels of asthma, increasing levels of asthma in young children, and it's especially dangerous for old
mm-hmm.
folks,
mm-hmm.
people whose immune systems and basic resilience, physical resilience, is not great.
Yeah, I don't know if listeners are aware that in a 2002 census by the Centers for Disease Control, National Institutes of Health, that there were reported in adults alone in the United States, 80 million adults with respiratory diseases. I mean, to me, that's an incredible epidemic that we should be jumping up and down on our tables and demanding something happening. And
well, we got there by talking about externalized costs.
Indeed.
You know, the actual costs, the internalized costs of mining coal are pretty cheap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you look at the overall spectrum, the impacts on society,
mm-hmm.
30,000 deaths a year is by no means cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put a dollar value on that, it starts becoming a rather significant cost.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's a huge societal cost to mining coal. When those costs are factored in, and it's going to take a very forward-looking government, and probably a government that's only driven by people like the people of New Hampshire who are suing the coal-burning plants in the Midwest in order to alleviate that problem.
Right.
It's going to take that kind of action to really bring those costs to the forefront, at which point things like geothermal, solar energy, separation of hydrogen and using some of these what are considered alternatives but really should be mainstream because they're pragmatic,
mm-hmm.
they don't have the externalized consequences,
mm-hmm.
the health costs and so forth.
Sure.
But eventually the dollar figure attached to them will become competitive
mm-hmm.
with the dollar figures attached to coal, nuclear,
mm-hmm.
Natural gas and others.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, most of this stuff is driven by the market.
Mm-hmm.
And the market does not respond well to the externalized costs, the societal costs.
Mm-hmm. Just talking about the dollars here, well, I know we only have a couple of minutes, but I did want to mention that in this article or in this website by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, he says that by most estimates, it will require an investment of $180 billion over 10 years to develop these alternatives or these other ones that we're not using as much. But they will save $70 billion a year by 2025. So in the last couple of minutes, I know that you wanted to give our listeners a few ideas about how they can start local groups and petitions that are available at NEC's website, and also you wanted to talk about the Noel Paltz Turkey event as well as the Keene High School event. So if we
thank you for that intro.
Sure.
So I'll just give you a quick litany. I'm speaking to a group of high school students at Keene High School on Tuesday from 1 until 2 in the Keene High School auditorium, and it is open to the public. If you want to come, you are welcome to come, but you should get there well before 1 o'clock. Noel Paltz Turkey is Paul of the legendary Peter, Paul, and Mary. He is going to be giving a benefit concert for the New England Coalition on Saturday, February 26th, at the historic Lashes Theater in downtown Brattleboro, which is just an amazing venue. They're actually canceling, it's a movie theater now, but they're canceling the movies that night in the main theater to accommodate this benefit concert. You can get information for that at www.latches.com or at our website, the New England Coalition, which is www.necnp.org. And if you want to email me, you can send a letter to me at peter@necnp.org and ask me for the citizen's petition. We are pushing very hard right now to have a comprehensive, independent safety assessment performed at the Vermont Yankee plant. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in August and September did a tiny little weeny version of an assessment. They examined about 1% of the critical safety components of the plant. They found 8 violations of maintenance and safety violations. We contend they need to look at the whole plant. So we created a petition that you can send to your governor in New Hampshire, or if you live in Massachusetts, if you get this signal in Mass or Vermont, there's a petition that you can send to them as well. You can get the petition from me, peter@necnp.org, or give us a call at 802-257-0336. We want to set up citizen activist groups in every community. Just because you're 17 miles away from the reactor and you're outside the 10-mile emergency planning zone does not mean you should turn a blind eye to this really, really dangerous industrial disaster waiting to happen down in Vernon.
Well, on that note, we want to thank Peter Alexander, the executive director of the New England Coalition in Brattleboro, for coming by tonight and giving us quite an enlightening talk. Something else to think about besides the Super Bowl, and also some really good ideas for beginning to get together at the community level, discuss what's coming up for us in terms of energy, what are the issues impacting our community, and to start really talking about some medium and long-range plans. I want to just remind you that you can also get to the New England Coalition's website via the OASIS website, which is http://tinyurl.com/64YLP, and those are forward slashes, not backslashes. That's tiny, it's http://tinyurl.com/64YLP. And why is it tiny URL? Because otherwise it would be a really long URL. That's why we give you a really short one. So, Peter, once again, thank you for joining us, and thank you for helping us get, this is the third show of OASIS, helping us get going here with creating community awareness.
Thank you, John Michael, and I'd just like to say, for those who are listening, you do have the power, like Howard Dean says. There's so many positive things that you can do to make a difference. And if you want to learn more about them, just give me a call, and I'll give you plenty of material.
Wonderful. Thank you. And stay tuned here. We're on 91.3 WKNH Keene, and we'll be continuing with OASIS Journeys in just a few minutes. Thanks very much for joining us for this hour of OASIS Forum. For more information or to suggest topics or guests for the show, please call 357-5848 or write oasis_WKNH@hotmail.com. Or visit http://tinyurl.com/64YLP. We'll have a real website up at some point, but there we go. That'll at least give you some ideas for the upcoming schedule that we have. Next week, we'll be back at 7 p.m. for an interview with Lonnie Brown of Peterborough, New Hampshire, talking about spirituality at the personal and planetary level. please stay tuned for Oasis Journeys coming up in just a few minutes.